Hello, lovely listeners. Your host, Vanessa, here with a special announcement. This year, we are bringing back the minisodes. There will be a new one released on Friday, February 1st. Following that, there will be a new minisode released on the first of each month. I'll be talking to special guests about subjects a bit lighter than the ones I normally cover on the show, but still true crime related. So make sure to keep an eye and ear out for those starting February 1st. And now, back to our regularly scheduled program. Wildcat crime listeners should be aware that this episode contains descriptions of murder, violence, and sexual assault, and may not be appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Wildcat Crime, the monthly podcast dedicated to taking a closer look at some of the most infamous crimes to occur at the University of Arizona and within the Wildcat community. Brought to you by the Daily Wildcat and Camp Student Radio. My name is Vanessa Ontiveros, and I'll be your host. Now, I normally save this for the end of the show, but I want to start this episode by saying thank you all for listening. Not everyone understands why we are interested in true crime, and some might even find it repugnant. But I think there's something very valuable in looking at cases like the one I'll be talking about today. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this show. People are drawn to true crime for all sorts of reasons. I myself am often asked why I am so interested in this stuff that I'd want to pursue it professionally. And there are a lot of answers to this question. Humans, it seems, naturally have a sense of morbid curiosity. We've always been interested in this stuff, trust me. Another reason I tend to say is that I love people. I really do. I used to call myself an anthropophile because I thought it meant human lover, but I recently found out that the word anthropophilic means a parasite that prefers human hosts, so I have since stopped. But the sentiment remains the same. I am absolutely enamored with humans. But part of what intrigues me about true crime is that it shows us the absolute worst and best of humanity. People doing awful, unthinkable things, and people who work to help others. Many people who work in crime reporting express an almost compulsive desire to tell victims' stories. I'm not the first person to say this, but there's this feeling that we didn't do right by them in life, so we must try to do right by them in death. But we don't always. Sometimes the aftermath of the murder is almost as ugly as the crime itself. Now, there are extreme cases of this, such as how victims of killers are regarded as somewhat disposable if they led, quote, high-risk lifestyles. That's been a term used to describe murdered sex workers or gay men, and thus lessen the importance of the loss. It's victim-blaming and quite literal insult to injury. But sometimes, even when the victim is young and in college and has everything going for them, they still don't get the kind of treatment they deserve. In 1982, University of Arizona students Teresa Acuna and Susan England were murdered by Clifford Dean Lacey. From what I've read, they were both kind, caring young women with promising futures, who were violently taken from the world at only 19 years old. This is the story of the murders of Teresa Acuna and Susan England. Before we talk about the deaths of Terry Acuna and Susan England, we have to talk about their lives. Both women were 19 years old when they were murdered. In those 19 years, they distinguished themselves as wonderful people. Both were originally from Casa Grande, Arizona, and had graduated from Casa Grande Union High School, according to a Daily Wildcat article, the first written about the murders, by Joni Hirsch entitled, Two UA Women Found Shot to Death. I couldn't find any confirmation as to whether or not they were friends in high school, or even knew each other prior to college. They were sophomores at the UA at the time of their deaths. Teresa Renee Acuna was a very smart young woman. According to that first Daily Wildcat article, she was in the top 5% of her graduating class in high school. I couldn't find any record of what she was majoring in college. In another Daily Wildcat article, also written by Joni Hirsch, entitled Friends and Neighbors React to Shooting, Carrie Fulich, a friend of Teresa's, who called her Terry, described her as the quiet type, and yet also outgoing. She said that Teresa was special because she was always willing to help people out, a positive person who, quote, believed in people as a whole. A later Wildcat article entitled Memorial to be Held Today for Women Slain Last Week said that Teresa's artwork would be displayed in a student art show in the Union Gallery to honor her. There is a bit more information available about Susan England. Before college, she was the captain of her high school's cheerleading squad and held the school's all-around gymnastics record, according to that first Daily Wildcat article by Joni Hirsch. Betsy Gwynn, a friend from high school quoted in the second Daily Wildcat article, described her as good at everything and always in a good mood. She was majoring in sociology at the University of Arizona. In that first Daily Wildcat article, the one published right after the murders, a neighbor described them as, quote, very sweet girls. Another neighbor remembered that they always had friends over, people constantly coming and going from the apartment, which would become something of an issue in the early morning hours of March 24th, 1982. Before we get into the murders themselves, I have to be upfront about where I got this information. For this podcast, I relied heavily on the 1996 Arizona Supreme Court decision on State versus Lacey. When I mention the court decision or opinion throughout this episode, this is the one I am referring to. This was the appellate trial for Clifford Dean Lacey, the man who murdered Teresa and Susan. The most detailed account of that night came from Clifford. The most detailed account of that night came from Clifford's confession to law enforcement and his testimony in the trial, which means that the story of that night is being told by the murderer. This obviously presents some issues. Clifford Dean Lacey would probably not be classified as the world's most reliable narrator. He had his own agenda to push forward in the trial, and obviously told only one side of the story. However, it is still the most detailed account of that night that exists. Two of the people present at that time had the ability to tell their own story taken from them. One of the people present that night doesn't seem to be talking about it. So, I will still be using details of that night taken from the trial to tell the tale of the night Teresa Acuna and Susan England were murdered. At the time of the murders, March 24th, 1982, there were three people living in the apartment together. Teresa, Susan, and Susan's brother, Robert England, who was attending UA's medical school. According to the first Daily Wildcat article written by Joni Hirsch, Robert had only been staying with his sister for about a week. Robert told the court that on the night of March 23rd, he left the apartment at around 11 p.m. to go study in the library. The court opinion did not specify which of the university's libraries, but the apartment was less than a mile away from UA's campus. For reference, it was across the street from where Meadow West Apartments stands today. Robert told the court that he didn't lock the door of the apartment when he left, because Teresa was still at work, and he believed that she would lock it when she returned. His sister Susan was getting ready for bed. This is where the story switches to mostly Clifford Dean Lacey's account. According to what was reported in the court decision, Clifford and another man, Bruce Stubblefield, decided to target Teresa and Susan's home because Bruce said he knew one of the women, though which one was not specified, and believed she would provide him with the chemicals needed to make PCP, also known as angel dust. Clifford said that Bruce owed him money, and selling the angel dust would provide him with the funds to pay him back. I cannot find any evidence to support the idea that either Teresa or Susan would have had such chemicals, especially with them in their home, or would have given them to these men, according to a 1993 article from the Arizona Daily Star by Joe Salkowski entitled "Second Man Goes to Trial in 82 Killings of Two UA Students." Police found no evidence of the women engaging in the consumption or selling of illegal drugs. I also found no confirmation that either of the women knew Bruce Stubblefield, who would have been around 27 at the time of the murders, almost a decade older than Teresa and Susan. The first Daily Wildcat article by Joni Hirsch stated that investigators found a screen had been removed from one of the apartment windows. However, the court opinion stated that the police did not find any evidence of forced entry at the crime scene. Either way, once inside the apartment living room, according to Clifford, Bruce asked Susan for the chemicals. They began to argue when she wouldn't give them to him. During the argument, Bruce hit Susan, according to Clifford's account. That's when Teresa, who must have returned home from work at some point between Robert England leaving and the murders, came out of her room and swung a wrench at Bruce. Bruce then revealed that he had a gun and shot Teresa in the face, according to Clifford Dean Lacey. The court opinion stated that Teresa was found to have been shot once in the face and once in the back of the head, though the order in which her gunshot wounds had been inflicted could not be determined. According to Clifford, Bruce then hit Susan in the head with the gun. Clifford said that at that point, he looked around for something else to steal and took a microwave from the apartment. Robert England would later tell the courts that their stereo system and his medical bag were also missing. Either way, Clifford told authorities that he took the stolen oven to some bushes near the apartment and returned to the apartment to find Bruce tying up Susan. According to Clifford, Bruce then shot Susan in the head. Clifford stated that he ran away at that point, though shortly later he was picked up by Bruce in his car, who told Clifford to shut up when he asked why Bruce had shot the women. He then drove Clifford home. I could not find a definitive time of the murders, and there is a lot of conflicting information about when neighbors heard different disturbances. According to that first Daily Wildcat article by Joni Hirsch, which was published on March 25, 1982, the day after the murders, one neighbor reported waking up at 2:23 a.m. on March 24th to the sound of barking dogs. He said that, curious, he looked out his window and saw a car backing up. He later heard the car door slam and someone enter Teresa and Susan's house. After that came the sounds of kicking and slamming, and later the sound of the car driving away. Another neighbor reported in that same article that at some time during the night he heard the sound of screams, but did not provide a specific time. A third neighbor stated in the article that he saw a man with a flashlight walking down the street at 2 a.m. In the court decision, which was released in 1996, 14 years after the night of the murders, a neighbor and fellow student was on his bicycle headed to the library at about 2 a.m. when he heard noises coming from the women's residence and rode towards them. He said that he saw a light-colored compact car leave the women's driveway. Regarding cars, Robert England's white Dodge Omni was also taken from the scene, according to both the first Daily Wildcat article and the court decision. In that first Daily Wildcat article, a neighbor stated he saw the car driving away from the apartment at about 2:40 a.m. It was later found, abandoned, by officers about a mile and a half from the apartment. The interior is burned. Fingerprints that matched Susan's were the only ones that could be pulled from the car, according to the court decision. The court decision also stated that two partial shoe prints were found near the car that matched shoe prints found in the women's apartment and in their front yard. They had a diamond-shaped pattern on them. A matching print was also found inside one of the apartment bedrooms, implying that Clifford had entered the bedroom and had been near the stolen car, and in his testimony, had likely downplayed his role in the robbery and murders, according to the court decision. When Robert Englund returned to the apartment at about 5:30 a.m. on March 24th, he found the body of his sister lying dead in the living room, according to the court decision. He found Teresa's body while speaking with the 911 operator. She was draped across a bed with a wrench nearby. According to the original Joni Hirsch Daily Wildcat article, he initially tried to give the women mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, but they were already dead. When he found them, Teresa's pants had been pulled down to her knees, and her legs were raised in an unnatural position, according to an Arizona Daily Star article from 1993 by Tessie Borden. This would lead to rumors that rape had been the motive for the murders. However, the autopsy found that neither woman had been sexually assaulted, according to a Daily Wildcat article entitled, "Autopsy Reports Dispel Rumors of Sexual Assault." Robert found his sister's body with her hands tied behind her back using a telephone cord, her mouth gagged using one of his shirts, according to an Arizona Daily Star article by Joe Selkowski. The autopsy would determine that Susan had a blunt force injury on the right side of her head, near the scalp, and three gunshot wounds behind her right ear. There were fresh scratches on her arm. I spoke with Susan Knight, an associate professor of practice in the UA's School of Journalism, who used to work at the Arizona Daily Star as a general assignment reporter, mostly covering educational issues, but sometimes taking on the crime beat. I reached out to her because of her journalistic experience, but to my surprise, she also knew Robert Englund. Her boyfriend at the time of the murders was friends with Robert, who she called Bob or Bobby. She recalled the morning of the discovery.
At 10 o'clock, I was in the newsroom at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the Tucson Citizen came out. And on the front page of the store of the Citizen, filling the entire front page, was a picture of a crime scene. And there in the middle was my friend Bobby, who was basically obviously going insane, standing outside of, you know, this investigation that was going on in his apartment. He had come home to find the two girls murdered. And I knew my boyfriend was home working in the garden. So I just split. I just grabbed the paper, ran out of the newsroom, drove home, and showed him the picture. And I said, "This is Bobby." It had, the cut line had said, "Brother of one of the victims on the scene." But I knew it was him immediately. So my boyfriend at the time raced over there. And by that time, a number of Bobby's friends had showed up, and they were kind of circling him in a group hug. He is a hysterical guy. He's funny. He is so smart. And he just wears his feelings on his sleeve, and he was flipping out. And I'm sure to a lot of people it seemed like unusual, weird behavior, but Bobby was just howling, basically.
When the police arrived, Robert had blood all over him from his attempts at reviving the women. He was taken into questioning by the police for 2 hours, but was quickly ruled out as a suspect, according to that first Daily Wildcat article. I spoke with UAPD Public Information Officer Sergeant Cindy Spassoff about how law enforcement would approach a situation like this, in which a victim's family member is the first person to discover the bodies. Now, I should be upfront and mention that UAPD was not involved in the 1982 investigation. It was handled by the Tucson Police Department because the murders occurred off campus.
Yeah, so when we're investigating a crime, especially when we don't have any idea what happened, and especially a crime of such severity, it's kind of one of those like leave no stone unturned type of scenarios where for the benefit of the victims and going through the true process, we want to make sure that we talk to everybody as long as we need to ensure that justice is served for the victims, the families, because we don't know who has done anything. And so I think it's very important when we arrive on scene, if a person is there, is to get all the information from that person that we can. But then we also have to turn and respect that person is emotionally dealing with what they've seen, whether they did it or not. And those people also need time to cope and grieve and mentally prepare themselves for being interviewed. So it's not necessarily like, we know you have information, but we want you to give us the information when it's right for you too. And so just because it's 2 hours doesn't mean that they were talking for 2 hours. I've been on cases where I've went and got food for people, or I've let them go to the bathroom, or I've let them call their parents or talk to people, because those people are only as helpful as they can be in the situation that they are. So I think taking care of and providing that self-care for that person is also very important.
During the police investigation, they found the shoe prints, as was mentioned earlier. They also found several fingerprints in the apartment, but none of them matched fingerprints taken later from Clifford and Bruce. According to the court decision, officers found bullet casings that they managed to link to a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol. After the autopsy ruled out sexual assault, burglary was considered the official suspected motive for the murders, according to the Daily Wildcat. However, aside from those initial findings, leads in the case very quickly dried up. We know now that Clifford Dean Lacey was involved in the murders, but he would not be identified until over a year later. And without a police case to follow, community members were left to deal with the aftermath of the murder essentially on their own. When examining the aftermath of the murders, I decided to take a ripple effect approach and start by looking at those closest to the young women and moving outward into the large community. In this case, the person closest to the murders and the first affected by them would have been Robert England. He was the one to find the bodies, and in such an unimaginable state. I can't even begin to comprehend how awful that would be or how much it would affect a person. I wanted to know more about, emotionally, what occurs after a violent death, like a murder, and what the grieving and healing process is like. So I spoke to a UA alumna and psychotherapist, Betty J. Wittels. She graduated with her master's in rehabilitation counseling in 1976 and has 43 years of experience working in the field of psychotherapy. I asked her what she thought the grieving process would be like after a violent, unnatural death. Now, Betty was getting over a cold at the time of our interview, so the audio quality might not be particularly high, but the content of her responses still stands.
Well, I think within the family and the community, there's, of course, shock. Everyone is in limbo for a few hours to a few days. You don't know what to think. You aren't thinking. You're just in shock. You're numb. Whereas if it's a natural death or illness or a natural cause, you start thinking, well, you know, they were suffering. You know, things had deteriorated, etc.
Something that must have exacerbated that feeling of grief for both families was that the police really had no suspects. Without a suspect or even a definitive motive, the grief had room to fester. Here's what Betty had to say about why such unanswered questions would hinder the healing process.
Because you don't know if there could have been reasons, like if they had a real enemy, or say they cheated someone, you know, out of some money, or stole a car, you know, I mean, one of the people that were murdered. I mean, they don't know. Well, was it some vendetta from somebody else? Was this just out of the blue? I think when you know who did it, that gives some sort of explanation as to whether it was random or sometimes was it intended.
According to a Daily Wildcat article by Joni Hirsch entitled Friends and Neighbors React to Shootings, a rosary service was held on the night of March 25th for Teresa Acuna at Cole and Maud Mortuaries in Casa Grande. Her funeral was held at St. Anthony's Catholic Church in Phoenix the day after. The article also said that a memorial was to be held for Susan England in Tucson at Arizona mortuaries, though did not specify when. Susan's funeral was held in California, though a more specific location or reason was not provided. A memorial service was held on April 1st for Teresa and Susan in front of the Arizona State Museum, according to a Daily Wildcat article entitled, "Memorial to be Held Today for Women Slain Last Week." The memorial took place under an African sumac tree near the museum that was a favorite spot for the young women, according to Mario Garcia, a friend of both Teresa and Susan who helped organize the memorial. Two clergymen spoke at the service, as well as friends and family members of the murder victims. A Daily Wildcat article by Bill Daly that ran the day after, entitled "England, Acuna Remembered by More Than 250 at Service," quoted multiple people close to the young women. One friend, Gary Stevens, said, quote, "They would come here and sit under this tree and listen to the birds, and they would think, and they would watch people. That's the way they should be remembered," end quote. The idea of how the women should be remembered, what their lives should mean now that they were over, essentially their legacy, was one that Susan's brother, Robert, the one who found the women, also spoke about. He was quoted in the article as saying, quote, "The best tribute we can give them now is to just go on living, get back to being the caring people we all are, and above all, live, be happy, and laugh, because that's something neither of them would ever shy away from," end quote. Something I got a sense of through all of the Daily Wildcat articles is that this was an event that seemed to affect pretty much everyone on campus. I found another Daily Wildcat article, no author given, in the perspective section that said, quote, "The killings are particularly troubling to young people, who are generally less acquainted with the death of peers," end quote. This idea really stuck with me. I may read about death all day for my job, but I don't personally have much experience with loss and grief. So I asked Betty what happens to a community when a young person is murdered.
I think in the community, especially when the character of the young person is divulged, you know, whether they were straight A student or, you know, they rode motorcycles or, you know, they were going to learn how to fly airplanes. When we know a little bit about what was going on with that young person, it's more painful, but at least we can see it was a real person. And as I mentioned earlier, it appears that a lot of times it is the pure ones that are taken.
However, accompanying this communal sense of grief was an overwhelming sense of fear. Two women were killed in their own home, and the person or people who did this are still out there. That is a terrifying sentence. According to the Wildcat article entitled "Friends and Neighbors React to Shootings," that fear caused people to react in all sorts of ways. Door locks were double-checked where before they would not have even been locked. Some neighbors took to arming themselves. Some people became more withdrawn and went out less. Those who did go out began doing so in a more careful manner. According to a Daily Wildcat article by Tom Calandra, the UA's Daily Escort Service, a sort of pedestrian precursor to Safe Ride, that had male students accompany students who felt unsafe walking at night, had to increase their boundaries and were receiving a 50% increase in calls in the days after the murders. Interestingly, one volunteer dispatcher interviewed for the article said all of the requests for the escort service she received came from women, and only men were eligible to volunteer to be escorts, and there was no screening process, though the escorts were affiliated with various campus organizations, mostly fraternities and ROTC. Teresa and Susan were 19 when they were murdered. I am 19, and I read about violent deaths as a part of my job, but I still find myself saying, I'm young. I can't be hurt. The idea that young people feel like nothing bad will ever happen to them, that they are invincible, that they are immortals here to inherit the earth, is not a new or novel one. But when this belief is broken, it doesn't just break, it shatters. Here's what Betty had to say about the subject.
So that would be really troubling because it's bringing death so close, and one assumes when one's young, we really do, that we're invincible, like we're protected at least until we're old. I'm serious, I think that's how they look at it. I think that's how I looked at it, you know? But I think more than that, it should be troubling to everybody. And it's not. It's so easy to skip our feelings.
This feeling of a lack of safety can easily transform into a sense of helplessness. But community members decided in the days after the killings to take action. On Monday, March 29th, a meeting was attended by over 200 people at a Circle K convenience store, which initially put up a sign pleading for something to be done about local crime in the neighborhood where Teresa and Susan were killed, according to a Daily Wildcat article by Ellen Ettinger entitled, Area Residents Learn About Watch. The meeting was on the possibility of establishing neighborhood watch-type groups in the area. At the time, the meeting and community support for enhanced safety measures earned praise from the Tucson Police Department. Lieutenant Michael Leverance with the Tucson PD was quoted in the article as saying, quote, I think it's significant that the NCAA basketball championships and the Academy Awards were on the TV, and yet we managed to shake more than 200 people out of their homes to go to a neighborhood store. End quote. Jumping forward to 2019, when I spoke to Cindy Spassoff about law enforcement positions towards community action and bystander intervention, here's what she had to say.
We really try to employ the saying, see something, say something. We've become a society where you kind of mind your own business. And we're also a community that is very busy and going on about their day. They have classes and lots of things going on and, you know, trying to get from class to class in a certain amount of time and trying to lock up your bike and trying to do so many things that I think we forget about the world around us. And not realizing the magnitude of one single phone call or one single action that could really maybe change somebody's life. But the bystander intervention is something that's really important, and we're really trying to make students aware that you would want somebody to help you out, but also don't put yourself in a position of getting hurt or being uncomfortable too.
But there is a fine, fine line between telling people to stay safe and telling people that their safety is 100% their fault. Sometimes, advice on how to stay safe can come across as victim-blaming, such as in 1982 when a member of a local crime-fighting group stated in a Daily Wildcat article written by Tom Calandra that a better knowledge of crime-fighting techniques might have prevented the murders. Statements like this, however well-intentioned they may or may not be, put the burden of personal safety on the victim, making them culpable in their own assaults. This didn't sit well with me. But on the other hand, I'm an educated girl living in 2019. I know to lock my doors, to not walk alone at night, to carry pepper spray and skepticism with me at all times. I know that if telling people don't murder worked, there would be no more murders. In my experience studying criminal activity, there are some people you can't really reason with, so you focus on the ones you can reach, which usually ends up being past or potential victims. It's an imperfect system, no doubt. Here's what Cindy Spassoff had to say about it.
You know, I always hate to make people feel like they need to take extra steps to keep themselves safe, because really it's not their fault. You know, it's not something that they did or should have done or could have done. I mean, really, the ultimate fact is that people shouldn't be looking for people to victimize, and people need to really, like, live the golden rule, like, you know, treat others how you want to be treated. And while there are lots of different things people can do to maybe prevent things, ultimately we need to focus on the reasons why people are committing these crimes and trying to keep an eye on each other to make sure that these people aren't coming to campus to commit crimes or reporting things that seem suspicious. You know, of course, you can always lock your door to try to keep people out, and you can always, you know, call 911 when you see something suspicious. But ultimately, we just need to take care of each other and help each other out and just kind of keep an eye on each other and really just support the community. So that way, when we do have something happen or somebody around here that shouldn't be here, we can take care of it. You know, always locking your doors are always simple safety precautions, but that it's not up to the person to protect themselves. They shouldn't be victimized to begin with.
However, it's worth noting that one of the reasons that the community reaction in the days and weeks after the murders was so intense is because of the non-existent community reaction in the minutes and hours after the murders. I mentioned earlier when recounting the night of the murders that several neighbors came forward and said that they noticed suspicious activity, like screams and unknown cars coming from the apartment. But not one of them was concerned enough to check on the women or call the police. One of the neighbors in the first Daily Wildcat article by Joni Hirsch attributed this to living in an urban environment, which desensitized him to the sound of screams. Others said that the women always had friends over, and people went in and out of that apartment all the time, so they thought nothing of it. Whatever the reason, the fact is that no one came to help Teresa and Susan that night, and their murderer would remain on the loose for over a year before being brought to justice. According to the court opinion, Clifford Dean Lacey was brought into police custody on a burglary charge unrelated to the murders. However, on May 31, 1983, he confessed to the police what had happened in the apartment, painting Bruce Stubblefield as the murderer. Clifford would later say in his appeals trial that he confessed because the officer interrogating him promised to grant him leniency. However, the court found that the officer promised no such thing. Now, I could go into great detail about these trials, which altogether would go on for 13 years. But that would probably take a whole other podcast. And this is not the story of Clifford Dean Lacey's legal battles. This is the story of Teresa Acuna and Susan England's murder and the ways they were treated after death. But what happened to the murderer is still an important part of that story. So here is the abridged account of the trials of Clifford Dean Lacey and Bruce Stubblefield. Now, throughout this episode, I have only referred to Clifford Dean Lacey as the murderer, and have tried to preface mentions of Bruce Stubblefield's involvement with the fact that Clifford is the one who claims Bruce shot the women. And that is because Clifford Dean Lacey's testimony, in which he pins the murders on Bruce, was deemed inadmissible in court. An Arizona Daily Star article from 1993 by Joe Salkowski entitled, "Judge Rules Out Testimony from Murder Suspect, Trial is Delayed for Man Accused of Killing Two UA Students in 1982, explains why Clifford's testimony was thrown out, better than I probably could. I'm going to quote from the article and say, quote, "If one defendant in a case says something that implicates a second defendant, those statements normally cannot be used as evidence against the second defendant. The reason is that, in such situations, the first defendant usually exercises his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination and refuses to take the stand. That means using the statement would violate the second defendant's Sixth Amendment right to confront his accusers. The rule, which has evolved through years of appellate court decisions, holds that such statements cannot be assumed to be trustworthy, often because they tend to shift blame from the speaker to the second party." End quote. Without Clifford's testimony, there was very little evidence to convict Bruce Stubblefield, and he was acquitted. I want to make this very clear. Bruce Stubblefield was acquitted. cleared of all charges related to the murders of Teresa Acuña and Susan England, though he did spend time in prison for other crimes. The only man found guilty of the murders was Clifford Dean Lacey, largely due to his own testimony. Clifford was first sentenced in 1993 on two counts of first-degree murder. He was given the death penalty for his crime due to the fact that there were multiple victims and the crime was carried out in a particularly gruesome fashion. Clifford was found guilty due to something called the felony murder rule. Now, I am a true crime junkie, not a legal expert, but I'll try to explain this as best I can. Arizona's felony murder rule states that if a murder occurs as a result of a different felony, such as burglary, then the person who committed the intended felony is also responsible for the murder. Clifford Dean Lacey was sentenced to death, but in his appeals trial, which was made in the Arizona Supreme Court, his sentence was reduced to two consecutive terms of life in prison without the possibility of parole for at least 50 years. According to an Arizona Daily Star article by Howard Fisher entitled "Justices Overturn Death Penalty of Man Guilty in UA Coed Killings," this decision was influenced by testimony from Robert England given during the trial about Susan's work in Amnesty International and her personal disapproval of the death penalty, along with Teresa Acuña's father's testimony, in which he said that sentencing Clifford Dean Lacey to death was, quote, not going to help anything. There's nothing we can do to bring these women back. But that doesn't mean that we, as a society, should stop trying to treat them with respect. I think that after death, when a person becomes a legacy, something that they no longer have the power to change, it is a critically important time for us to consider how we talk about the victims. Now, crime reporting, I will say from firsthand experience, is a difficult beast. You are writing about literally the most vulnerable members of society, people who have already been taken advantage of. So it is important that you do your research and approach the situation with empathy. Or you could just follow Susan Knight's advice.
As a reporter, don't be a jerk.
There were a couple of issues I had with the coverage of the murders of Teresa and Susan. Firstly, the reporting and spelling of Teresa Acuña's name was wildly different from publication to publication. In the court decision, she was referred to as Teresa Acuña, spelled T-E-R-E-S-A, A-C-U-N-A. However, the Daily Wildcat consistently spelled her name as T-H-E-R-E-S-A, and the Daily Star referred to her as Acuña, A-C-U-A, time and time again. The Tucson Citizen called her Terry, and the 1982 UA yearbook identified her by her middle name, Renee. This may seem like a trivial issue, the spelling of a name, but this is a dead young woman we're talking about. There's little left of her besides her name. And then there was the inclusion of rumors in the articles. As I mentioned earlier, the Daily Wildcat reported on the rumors of possible sexual assault in the first article published about the murders, despite the police not being able to confirm such an idea. Now, it might be unfair to judge them by 2019 journalistic standards, but the inclusion of unsubstantiated claims, especially ones as serious as rape, can cause undue distress to the family and should not be taken lightly. When I spoke to Susan Knight, she remembered rumors that were also malicious and affected Susan England's family deeply by casting blame onto the already grieving brother, Robert.
There was a period of the coverage where he was considered a suspect. And the question is, by whom? The cops are obviously going to rule out members of the family. So at one point, Bobby was asked questions. Where were you? What were you doing? Why were you there? And some members of the local press picked up on that and decided to say that he was a suspect. And that was really traumatic for his friends, I assume for him, though I think he truly believed that you know, the truth would bear out, but for his family. And it was a, to me, it was a horrible sidestep, and some of the press held on to it a little too long.
As crime reporters, we cannot make waves in the ocean of tragedy that the family is already involved in. Sometimes, when you're wrapped up in a story, you can forget that these are human beings we are dealing with. And humans are unpredictable. You never know how your behavior will affect a person. Stick with the person who is already going through something unimaginable.
And people do. They, you know, they will remember the laughter that they heard from two cops at a scene, or a reporter being on his cell phone. You know, of course, we're all on our cell phones all the time, but in a way that seemed disrespectful of what was going on to the people who were suffering loss.
We need to do better. And I think we can. I think we're working towards it. Susan Knight said that in her experience, crime journalism has a long way to go. But it also has come pretty far.
Gosh, how many years has it been? I started in journalism in 1978. You can do the math. I've seen this change to journalists becoming more compassionate and more aware of what is involved with loss and grief and trauma and victimology.
I think with all the recent attention true crime has received, it has also led to a much-needed conversation about the ways in which we cover murders. There has been a long history of glorifying murderers while forgetting the victims, something I try so hard to avoid doing on this podcast. I think victim-centric narratives are the responsible future of this type of reporting. The queen of crime journalism herself, Edna Buchanan, who covered the crime beat for Miami during the 1980s, said it herself in her 2009 book, The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. I was reading the beginning of it in a used bookstore the other day and was struck by how much this woman just gets it. She gets why we do this job and why it matters. This excerpt, where Edna talks about choosing which murders she can cover in the paper, wanting to put them all in, but only being able to include some, and those only being given one or two paragraphs each, really stuck with me, and I can't stop thinking about it. Quote, "I felt obliged. Often it was the first and last time the victims' names ever appeared in a newspaper. Even at that, I felt a sense of guilt for such a cursory send-off. The woman left dead by the side of a desolate road in her yellow nightgown wanted to live just as much as you or I do. So did the illegal alien whose charred body was found in a cheap trunk in the Everglades. How dehumanizing to be regarded merely as numbers in the mounting statistics of death. They deserved better. Often, assistant city editors, short on space and patience, would insist that I select and report on only the major murder of the day. I know what they meant, but I fought the premise. How can you choose? Every murder is major to the victim." End quote. When crime reporting is done well, it can be incredibly powerful. It exposes us. It is so incredibly human in a way that a lot of other reporting never feels to me. So I just want to end this podcast the way I began it, by saying thank you. From the Daily Wildcat and Camp Student Radio, this has been Wildcat Crime. Thank you all for listening. Till next time. Thank you for listening to this episode of Wildcat Crime. If you liked it and want to hear more from us in the future, please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. It really does help the show. And tell your friends. And follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Wildcat Crime Pod. Feel free to message us with questions, comments, or episode ideas. You can also reach us by emailing vanessao@dailywildcat.com. This episode was researched, written, recorded, and edited by yours truly, Vanessa Ontiveros. Recorded in Camp Studios. Our logo was designed by Nick Trujillo. Our music was Ghost Dance by Kevin McLeod. Special thanks to everyone at Camp Student Radio. Special thanks to everyone at the Daily Wildcat. And a very special thanks to everyone who appeared on the podcast today. Cindy Spassoff, Susan Knight, and Betty J. Wattels. Once again, thank you all for listening. This has been Wildcat Crime. Till next time.